really kind of magnified these sort of tugs and put into question whether these tugs are actually capable of handling the seas in this part of the world.
Two accidents highlight tug safety concerns along the Inside Passage in Canada. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Iditarod is creating new standards for dog kennels.
There needed to be a better way to communicate what was really happening in our Iditarod kennels.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance for next year? Did you know Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 20% for 2018? More than 90% of Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the costs. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th of this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2018. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Alaska's two U.S. senators not only helped Republicans pass the tax cut bill early Saturday, they made a pair of last-minute additions, one to kill a new tax on the cruise industry, another to help Alaska Native corporations. Senator Dan Sullivan offered the cruise ship amendment. It erased a section of the bill that would have taxed foreign-flagged cruise ships for the time they spend in U.S. waters. The tax would have raised an estimated $70 million a year. John Binkley represents the cruise industry as president of Cruise Lines International Association Alaska. He says the tax would have specifically hurt Alaska routes because they spend so much of their time in U.S. waters.
We were concerned when we saw that come up in the Senate version and contacted Senator Sullivan, his office, and also Senator Murkowski's office to see about either getting a hearing on that provision or getting it taken out.
Sullivan's spokesman says the senator had already noticed the tax in the bill and moved to ditch it to help Alaska communities that benefit from cruise ship visitors. Senator Lisa Murkowski added her own 11th-hour amendment to the bill. It provides favorable tax treatment for Alaska Native corporations that put land or other assets into Alaska Native settlement trusts. Congress created these trusts in 1988 in part to allow Native corporations to help Alaska Natives born after the 1971 Settlement Act, too late to be allotted shares in the corporations. Old Harbor Native Corporation CEO Carl Mars testified at a U.S. Senate hearing last month on the need to change tax law for settlement trusts. He says by law, a corporation's duty is to its shareholders.
We need a mechanism to be able to move assets over to take care of the whole, not just those that were born prior to 1971.
Mars says the tax changes would, among other things, allow a corporation to put pre-tax funds in a settlement trust. The trust would be taxed on the income, but the rate is much lower. Mars describes it as a way a community's corporation can help its tribe.
I think corporations are now realizing our job should be there supporting the tribal efforts, because those are the important programs to our Indigenous people.
On Friday night, the cruise ship and Native corporation amendments appeared on a list of 30 changes Republicans had decided to make. The list emerged while Democrats were on the Senate floor complaining they still had not seen the final language of the tax cut bill. Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer groused that his side had to get the list from lobbyists.
My Republican friends allowed lobbyists to see amendments and likely the text of this bill before their fellow U.S. senators.
The tax bill, including a provision to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, will be sent next to a conference committee with the House version so lawmakers can write the final bill. A near miss involving an Alaska-bound tug and tanker barge hauling millions of gallons of fuel through the Inside Passage has reignited debate in Canada over shipping petroleum through its territory. Jacob Resnick reports for Alaska's Energy Desk.
A mishap involving a Skagway-bound fuel barge was big news the next day in Western Canada.
Good afternoon. Well, it appears a disaster was averted off the central BC coast. A barge carrying
the incident near Bella Bella, British Columbia, and Canada's portion of the Inside Passage was just a few miles from a similar incident last year.
Super traffic, Nathan E. Stewart, good morning. We have run aground here. Seaforth Channel.
In October last year, the Nathan E. Stewart tug had just unloaded its fuel cargo in Ketchikan. Its distress calls to the Canadian Coast Guard were obtained and published by Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. About 29,000 gallons of diesel fuel spilled. A nearby clam fishery used by the Heiltsik First Nations tribe remained shut down 13 months later. Canadian authorities had been criticized over a delayed response and slow cleanup efforts. So when last Sunday's close call involved the tug Jake Shearer and a 430-foot barge loaded with fuel, there was renewed outcry and concern. Harley Marine Services, the parent company of the tug operator, isn't commenting, citing the open investigation by Transport Canada. But in Bella Bella, a community of 1,600, people have been listening intently to chatter on the VHF radio and talking to crew members and Coast Guard officials. William Hostey is a Heiltsik First Nations incident commander. Here's what he's heard.
The actual tug and barge was hit by a rogue wave, causing one of the pegs that holds the tug to the barge to break, and that led the crew to release themselves completely from the barge because it was putting the tug in danger.
Two crew members were able to jump from the tug to the loose barge and drop its anchor. Otherwise, it could have run aground or broken up on a rock pile, he says. He could see from the air just meters away.
And we've had these two incidents in the last year. It's really kind of magnified these sort of tugs and put into question whether these tugs are actually capable of handling the seas in this part of the world.
In the wake of the wreck last year, restrictions on barge traffic had actually been tightened by Canadian authorities. The tug Jake Shearer and its barge were apparently heeding new navigation restrictions on transiting fuel vessels that require them to avoid certain narrow straits in the area.
The American tug and barge industry have been going up and down this coast for over a century.
Kevin Obermeyer heads Canada's Pacific Pilotage Association, which regulates marine navigation on its west coast. The association routinely issues waivers to the fuel companies so their vessels aren't required to have a Canadian pilot on board, as is required of other heavy vessels. Since the Exxon Valdez spill, the U.S. requires vessels carrying petroleum cargo to have an approved contingency plan for spills and fires. Canada doesn't.
The oversight that we do is make sure that the officers and crew on those vessels have been going through these waters sufficiently to have the experience and knowledge to do it safely.
But that might not be enough. The Canadian government has proposed banning full-size tankers in the Inside Passage, even though they don't use that route. But tugs and barges like the Jake Shearer and Nathan E. Stewart would remain exempt.
We're banning something that doesn't occur, but we've got all this marine traffic passing through our Canadian waters, and Canadians are saying, look, we're taking all this risk, but we're getting no benefit.
Joe Spears is a retired maritime law attorney who runs an oceans consultancy in Vancouver.
So, you know, this is a pretty much a live issue, and it affects Alaska, and I think we need to sit down and talk about this because, you know, all of Southeast Alaska depends on this. On these tugs and barges to, you know, get the refined petroleum products.
There's no tracking how much fuel is shipped to Southeast Alaska. One industry estimate is 50 million gallons annually, but there's no hard data kept by the U.S. or Canadian authorities. But it's a lot, because of the geography and the demand. Talk to fuel retailers in Southeast Alaska, and the loss of fuel deliveries by barge would be unthinkable. Phil Isaac's family has owned Ike's Fuel in Douglas for more than a half century.
Depending on how cold it is, we can, you know, haul up to 400,000 gallons of heating fuel in a month or more. There's just no way you could haul that in. The barge will bring up 1 million gallons at a time. So, I mean, there's no way to replace that.
People in Bella Bella understand that. They get their fuel delivered the same way. But William Hostey in Bella Bella says it has to be done safely, and he's not sure these tug and barges are the way.
There's people along the coast that live here and that are, you know, depend on the resources in this area for survival, and to put all that at stake for the movement of fossil fuels is very difficult for people to fathom.
4 days after the incident, Canadian authorities admitted they'd grossly understated the amount of fuel carried in the barge. The vessels are carrying about 3.7 million gallons of diesel and gas, more than three times it had previously disclosed. The confusion, the agency said, came from mistaking liters for gallons. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Iditarod Trail Committee's Board of Directors wants to set up a kennel management program. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the move aims to set up new guidelines and counteract negative press.
Mushers who qualify for and race in the Iditarod are already expected to maintain standards of care for their animals and kennels, but many of those guidelines are fuzzy, outdated, and due for review. Now, the Iditarod's board is establishing an advisory committee made up of prominent mushers to begin drafting more specific standards for kennel management.
There needed to be a better way to communicate what was really happening in our Iditarod kennels.
Chaz St. George is ITC's operations director. He says board members have been considering setting up kennel management standards for several years. One of the motivating factors is a change over the last decade in how mushers run their dog lots, including more year-round training and tourism outside of the winter race season. St. George says the committee also wants to counter negative press leveled at the Iditarod and mushing community from animal rights activists.
This actually all began after the film Sled Dogs first came out. And we recognized right away that this film was literally attacking kennels, sled dog kennels that were used in tourism, and then trying to effectively show that there's a link there to Iditarod teams that run this race.
The hope is that the advisory group will have plans ready for implementing the kennel management program by June of 2018, as mushers are beginning to register for the next year's race. St. George says the particulars of the proposal don't yet exist.
What you're asking me is, how's this going to look? And I can't give you a definite how this is going to look.
In recent years, with dozens of mushers entering the Iditarod from around the globe, lower 48 states, and kennels in many far-flung parts of Alaska, policing dog lots for bad behavior is practically impossible for the Iditarod Trail Committee's small permanent staff. According to St. George, what's envisioned by the board of directors is less like a regulatory body with agents monitoring for compliance. Instead, the advisory group is more likely to come up with a set of best practices and guidelines for mushers, veterinarians, handlers, and community members. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
In other Iditarod news, trail officials say it's still too early to know if they'll be forced to modify the race's planned route because of snow conditions. The board of directors voted in May to break precedent and have the race follow its southern route in both 2018 and 2019. Typically, the event alternates between a northern path going through Middle Yukon communities like Galena and a southern route through the historic Iditarod checkpoint and several communities in the Yukon-Koyukuk census area. Poor snow conditions in sections of the Alaska Range in 2015 and 17 led to alternate routes that skipped those communities. Race officials hope back-to-back Iditarods through the area will help restore relationships and checkpoint protocols with residents. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, climate change in Shishmaref through the lens of a drone.
I just want to show those people that what we're dealing with on a daily basis. I mean, each storm is a bad storm.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, with complete technology solutions for organizations that keep Alaska's communities and economy thriving. GCI is your partner in possibilities. Now through December 15th is the open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska. Plan costs have gone down this year. For free help to enroll, visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
The state ferry Taku is not hip enough for Portland. Earlier this fall, a company based there placed the winning bid of $300,000 for the 54-year-old vessel. Keymar LLC's plans were to turn it into a floating hotel. But Alaska Marine Highway General Manager John Falvey says the company withdrew its bid earlier this month.
They cited regulatory issues, potentially other competing projects within their group, within their company, things like that.
Keymar Representative Jonathan Cohen says his group could not gain enough support from neighboring property owners to win required permits. In an email, he said the group is instead turning an old Columbia River school into a hotel. After that company pulled out, the state informed two other bidders from the last round that the 350-foot ferry was again for sale. Falvey says the top bidder offered $171,000, two-thirds more than the minimum needed.
Tuesday at 3 o'clock, we opened the bids, and the winner was a company called Jamal Laws Trading Company from Dubai in the Emirates, who I believe is purchasing the ship to take it for scrap.
So it might end up in a marine junkyard, but he's not sure. Attempts to contact the company were not successful, but the Juno Empire reports the company plans to use it as a ferry in the Philippines. Falvey says the company already paid a $25,000 deposit. The balance will need to be in hand before he can sign sale documents. The timing has not been determined. In a state where vanity plates are aplenty, Alaskans now have one more way to get creative with their cars, the new artistic license plate. The Alaska State Council on the Arts announced the winning design in a press release yesterday. A UAA graphic design student from Palmer submitted the winning plate, which showcases spruce trees, tall snow-covered peaks, and a teal-green blend of aurora lighting up the night sky. According to the Arts Council, more than 17,000 people voted on their favorite of five designs. The winning design will be in circulation by the DMV for the next 4 years until the next competition. The plates will be available to purchase in early summer of 2018, with proceeds going to artistic and cultural programs by the Alaska State Council on the Arts. A student from the University of Alaska was recently selected as the first recipient from the School of the Rhodes Scholarship. The academic award is one of the oldest and most prestigious in the country. The grant funds 2 to 3 years of study at Oxford University in the UK. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, the young woman is from southwest Alaska along the Aleutian Chain.
24-year-old Samantha Mack never expected to be named the first Rhodes Scholar from the University of Alaska.
Yeah, I cried. I definitely cried. I was so surprised. I still don't think it has fully set in. You know, I think every couple of days it sort of sinks in a little deeper and I have like an oh my God moment.
Among the application requirements for the award, Mack had to write an essay to the Rhodes Scholarship Foundation. She decided to write about commercial fishing with her father in her hometown of King Cove. She also wrote about how, through her college experience, she was able to learn about and connect with her Aleut heritage. Mack says her ties to the King Cove region in the Aleutian chain are deep.
My dad's family is the biggest family in King Cove, and my mom's family is the second biggest family in King Cove. So I've got quite the extended family mishmash going on, which is, you know, absolutely wonderful.
Mack's father works as a commercial fisherman out of King Cove. When Mack was young, her mother moved to Anchorage so she would have better educational opportunities. Mack describes herself as a voracious reader. Some of her favorite authors include J.R.R. Tolkien, Stephen King, and Neil Gaiman. Mack says while she wasn't a bad student in primary school, her grades weren't of the caliber that out-of-state universities salivated over, and getting financial aid to those colleges was difficult. That was the main reason she attended UAA, where she thrived as a student. She says a big reason was the level of care her professors took with her in her academic development.
You know, encouraging me to apply for internships, for fellowships, for summer programs and different things like that. And I mean, honestly, without that kind of prodding, I don't think I would have, I wouldn't be here.
In college, Mack worked on projects researching early Alaska fish policy, attended the United Nations Forum on Indigenous Issues, and served as an intern for Senator Dan Sullivan in Washington, D.C., among other extracurriculars. Mack says learning about her culture as an Alaska Native woman was at the core of her college experience. She notes that while she's not 100% sure, there's a good chance that she's the first Alaska Native Rhodes Scholar.
I think I might be. If so, that's amazing. I know I'm the first person from my Native corporation to receive the scholarship, so either way, it's an just beyond incredibly prideful moment for me. I just feel so proud to be representing my people that way.
Mack also says that she wants to become a university professor to bring the same representation to other Native students.
To be able to be a Native person and represent that as an instructor, I think is really important for other, you know, Native students coming in from wherever they might be from in the state and come to Anchorage, where it's a very big divorce in lifestyle. You know, it's not really similar for most people, but to get to see something of themselves and somebody that they're learning from is really important, I think, and something that I certainly didn't experience until recently.
Before heading to the UK for her scholarship, Mack is finishing up her master's program in English at UAA. She says she wants to get a PhD in political science while at Oxford, and possibly a doctorate in English down the road. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
How do you get people to care about climate change? One Shishmaref resident has an answer. Drones. Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
Look up Dennis Davis on YouTube and you'll find gorgeous, sweeping footage of Shishmaref from above, set to the music of bands like Portugal the Man. His videos show the narrow island covered in snow, its buildings alarmingly close to the water.
It just gives you that different perspective. And I was looking at online on YouTube at videos and stuff like that. And I was like, this would be perfect to show people like what's happening here in Shishmaref.
What's happening in Shishmaref, of course, is a lot of erosion. As its protective sea ice diminishes and its permafrost deteriorates, the community is more susceptible to storm surges. And the thin barrier island in the Chukchi Sea is becoming ever thinner. Davis started using the drone about 3 years ago to document the changes. He says people outside don't always get it.
I just want to show those people that, you know, what we're dealing with on a daily basis. I mean, each storm is a bad storm. We're on this island. There's nowhere to run.
Davis is a former police officer who's maybe best known online as a serious foodie. On Twitter and Instagram, where he goes by the handle Eskimo Fixer, breathtaking images of storm damage are interspersed with possibly more breathtaking photos of his culinary creations, like a seriously beautiful muktuk and kimchi bowl. But his big goal is to use his striking drone footage and social media to get the word out about what's happening to his community.
I feel that if I don't do this, then we're just basically out of sight, out of mind. And nobody's really going to know what's happening out in Shishmaref.
Right now, Davis is running a crowdfunding campaign to replace his current drone with one that can fly further and handle high winds. Plus, he wants to give the world a sense of life in Shishmaref, outside its status as a symbol of climate change.
You know, like when people are out fishing or checking their nets, or, you know, out hunting in the ocean. Just to show people just a little glimpse of, like, this is what's really happening. This is how life is out in the village.
Davis has ambitions to fly the drone out over the sea ice to scout the best route for people headed out hunting and do Facebook Live broadcasts in the middle of big storms. Ultimately, he says it's a way to connect people outside to what's happening on the ground or in the air. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Keep my hands on myself. Pick up, dust them off, put them back up on the shelf.
They started out as a modest indie band with deep roots in Alaska. But Portugal the Man has ascended to national and even international popularity. The Portland-based group's music has long been described as alternative rock, but their song Feel It Still recently earned their first Grammy nomination in the pop category. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove caught up with co-founder Zach Carruthers about the Grammy nod, the band's continuing success, and how growing up in Alaska shaped them.
Please welcome back to the show, Portugal the Man.
That's Conan O'Brien introducing the band on his show earlier this year. And the crowd's reaction is a taste of what they've been hearing from fans and critics alike about their song, Feel It Still. It's a hit. The single is off their newest album, Woodstock, and it has spent weeks at the top of music charts, peaking at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100. Not bad for some Alaska-grown guys. Co-founder Zach Carruthers spoke by phone while walking around Atlanta before a show. He says the attention has been surreal.
We absolutely don't belong in that world, which is funny. I don't have a tan. I'm 36 years old. I'm from Wasilla, Alaska. and they were playing next to Selena Gomez and stuff like that. It's wild.
Besides Carruthers, the band includes vocalist and guitar player John Gourley and guitarist Eric Houck, who are joined by Kyle O'Quinn on keyboards and Jason Sechrist on drums. Like Carruthers, Gourley and Houck are originally from Alaska. Carruthers says the experience has been fun overall. It's given the band a chance to see the world, and he says their lives are a little easier than the days when they toured in a small van and ate out of a rice cooker in random parking lots. But it's still a lot of work.
Since Feel It Still has gotten massive, you know, our day-to-day lives haven't really changed. We still just go out on tour. We're just still on a bus or on an airplane, and we go and do a show. It's just those shows are getting bigger, but it's hard to see what's really happening when you're kind of in the eye of the hurricane.
Gourley has said the band's work ethic comes from growing up in Alaska and seeing how hard work is necessary for survival. Carruthers says the environment in the north contributes as well.
Growing up and how you grow up, it's at least half of what you're made of. Half of it is how you were brought up, and then the other half is what you see along the way as your adult life. I feel like Alaskans really know themselves.
He knows it'll be a completely different scene when the band walks the red carpet at the Grammys in January. They've been to some award shows already, and he describes them with one word, bright. But Carruthers says the Grammys are a whole different level of attention.
It's a really weird world, and it's something just very strange to see, especially coming from Alaska, you know. It's just things that you saw in movies or on TV, and you never really expect to be there, but it's really fun.
Carruthers says the Alaskan members of Portugal the Man will take a break from touring to head north for Christmas. Then, on January 28th, they'll be in New York for the 60th Annual Grammy Awards at Madison Square Garden. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes, Emily Russell, Casey Grove, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, and Jacob Resnick and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the lead federal agency, is hosting a series of public scoping meetings on the proposed Ambler Road. The meetings are now through Tuesday, December 12th, in several communities near the Ambler Mining District. The BLM is developing an environmental impact statement and seeking public input. Learn more at blm.gov/AmblerRoadEIS. This message is sponsored by BLM.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.